Thou shalt love thy God with all thy heart and soul. Thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself. Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, liminalist. This is The Liminalist, the podcast in between. You are now listening.
Like I'm walking a long way, just for another chap. And then I saw her in the crowd, and I looked her in the eyes.
This could be the Liminalist podcast. You never know. I'm in a liminal state as far as podcasting goes. I don't know if I'm going to do it or not. I shouldn't have to lean into the microphone. I shouldn't have to raise my voice. Apparently I do. Maybe that's part of what I'm learning now. Project the voice. Sound less stoned, less drunk. So, to podcast or not to podcast, that is the question. Freedom of speech. I tweeted something yesterday and again today, which I consider to be, I can remember it. I practically feel like it should be my motto or my byline at this point, but that's just how I'm feeling, I suppose, right now. It is that the idea of free speech is a luxury for those who've learned to police their own thoughts. I'll say it again. The idea of free speech is a luxury for those who have learned to police their own thoughts. There is no freedom of speech if there isn't freedom of thought. And one can very quickly find out how little freedom of thought there is if one says the wrong things. Of course, I'm not going to use any examples, because to do so I would have to say the wrong things. And there are consequences for saying the wrong things. Severe ones, even jail time. But certainly, more plausibly, more realistically, I would get lots of negative feedback, lose listeners, get a reputation, and so on. I won't say as what, because that would give the game away. Let's just say that I have views that, well, that I'm not willing to talk about openly, because there is no freedom of speech, because the narrative has been framed to such an extent that the things that we take as given and as necessary, essential human values, not all of them by any means, but some of them are the very things that need to be questioned. This isn't just about questioning whether we can trust the government. It's about questioning everything, and everything means everything. So, again, I don't have to give examples, but anything that you're afraid to say in any kind of company, those are the very things that need to be questioned by definition. There's a reason why there's pressure not to speak those things. And once the pressure is great enough not to speak them, there's an internal pressure not to even think them, because otherwise the alternative is to feel the pressure of not being able to speak them, of thinking things that are unspeakable. That pressure is intolerable for most people. And so they have a choice. Either they will speak them and risk the judgment and the wrath of the group, excommunication, isolation, scapegoating, or they will learn not to think them anymore. They will reprogram themselves and tell themselves these thoughts are wrong. They are wrong to think this. They are wrong to question these values. And eventually they will more fully integrate themselves with the group by thinking the way that the rest of the group thinks, and they will be able to get along. They will be able to speak freely because they no longer think anything that is forbidden to speak of. That is free speech. That's as good as it gets, folks, and it's only going to get worse. We have the technology now to hack into your thoughts, to transmit thoughts to you, the correct thoughts, the thoughts that will align you with the group and ensure your smooth functioning and passage through this life as a social member in the social body. This is the future that we are now living in. And well, it's, I think, what has inspired me to, if I do start podcasting again, if this is the beginning of a new podcast series, this is what's inspired me, is this feeling that I need to speak up, I need to speak out for my own peace, my own internal peace. But also knowing that there are others out there who feel the same as I do, and that's my only real message. I think that's the one that seems to be most frequently, consistently received, or at least that comes back to me, which is that you feel less alone, you, the collective you, that what I transmit helps others to feel less alone. You are not alone. You are in a very, very small minority, and it's only getting smaller, which is all the more reason to find others like ourselves and connect. That's my only mission, my only intent with this podcast, with everything I do, besides, of course, my own individuation process, my own integration of unconscious matter process that those of you who've listened and read me for the years, or through the years, already know well. Those are the only two motives or agendas that I'm conscious of. Right. So that said, I'm going to refer to my notes. It's like, maybe that's why I create something around Kubrick that will attract people who won't get it, because they're the ones who would really get it if they did get it. And why I want to talk about things that would shock and disturb and appall most liberal intelligentsia type people like Doug as kind of unthinkable. Like, come on, we want to take us back to the Dark Ages. We've made enough progress to know that are wrong, full stop. So for me to actually come along and say, well, actually no, we don't know that. They may actually be valid. That's really is verboten. At the same time, if you can't do that, you can't question anything. If you can't question everything, you can't question anything. That's what it comes down to. If you think that you can intellectually grasp what's going on here, then you've already fallen into the trap. And the only way to get out is to go towards the thing that you least want to go towards, kind of thing. You've got to go to the kingpin of your belief. And big trees falling down here. Wow, that's a big fall. She almost blocked the way to the lake now, which would suit the asshole owner here who chased me off one time, even though he never frickin' uses it. The double bind. I had not really heard of the double bind until very recently, when I was looking a bit deeper into liminality, or revisiting the subject of liminality and mimesis in relation to the Charlie Hebdo thing proposed at Rigorous Intuition. And it led to this discovery of what the double bind is. But I will read some of the posts that I made. I did make an audio about this liminal material a while ago for the Zero Squared podcast, but Doug Lane didn't like it. He thought it was too stormy weather, which is one other thing that I felt was a bit of a nudge towards starting up a new podcast. In ritual passages, members of the society are themselves aware of the liminal state. They know that they will leave it sooner or later and have ceremony masters to guide them through the rituals. However, in those liminal periods that affect society as a whole, the future is completely unknown, and there is no ceremony master who has gone through the process before and that can lead people out of it. In such cases, liminal situations can become dangerous. They allow for the emergence of self-proclaimed ceremony masters that assume leadership positions and attempt to perpetuate liminality, and by emptying the liminal moment of real creativity, turn it into a scene of mimetic rivalry. Mimesis, or the imitative aspect of human behavior, is an important aspect of liminality. Individuals who are trapped in a liminal situation are not able to act rationally for two reasons. First, because the structure on which objective rationality was based has disappeared, and second, because the stressful emotive character of a liminal crisis prevents clear thinking. This can lead to mimetic behavior on the part of the trapped individuals. A central characteristic of liminal situations is that by eliminating the stable boundary lines, they contribute to the proliferation of imitative processes and thus to the continuous reproduction of dominant messages about what to copy. Without stable institutions, people will look at concrete individuals for guidance. This notion of imitation is closely tied to that of the trickster figure.
Let me give you a little inside information about God. God likes to watch. He's a prankster. Think about it.
The people became so numerous.
Oh, lover, can you hear?
That all the gods got all depressed.
Oh, lover, can you hear?
This was the most terrible mess.
How day becomes a night.
I won't I sing into the mess, then I run away to meet you.
Being in a state of liminality, individually and collectively, is to be in a state of confusion, of not knowing what is next. The social structures or the internal beliefs and perceptions that have sustained us until now are no longer viable, are crumbling, are disappearing before our eyes, but there's no clear picture of what is emerging, if anything. This transitional liminal state can be continued indefinitely. A person can get stuck in it for the simple reason that there's no sense of which way to move, which way is forward. Just as in a social situation of chaos, if there's no clear vision of what can come from that chaos and what would restore order to that chaos, then the chaos is continued indefinitely. It is in the interests of the few to maintain a state of chaos indefinitely, because in a state of chaos, populations will have no sense of how to behave, no sense of which values or which structures or which institutions they can rely upon. They have no way of knowing how to behave, so they look to charismatic leaders to lead them. And this is where the trickster, or the false teacher, the false messiah, the deceiver enters in. And it is the job of the trickster, the untrustworthy leader, to both sustain the chaos, to keep his or her subjects in a liminal state of confusion, and to exercise and increase their power. The longer the state of chaos and of liminality is maintained, the more power the untrustworthy leaders can accrue for themselves. This is the criminality of liminality. This may also be why movies, celebrity, Hollywood, show business is the primary means of control and of sustaining chaos within which to exercise control in the present world. Because movie stars are liminal beings. They are neither themselves nor the characters that they play. They are projected images on the world's stage. They are mercurial, they are tricksters, they are false images, false idols, which the confused populace mistakenly attempt to imitate, never suspecting that they are imitating projections of their own unconscious, and therefore falling prey to possession of their most base instincts, which is simply to survive at any cost. Slavery is the safest, most secure position in a state of liminality, a state of chaos.
And then I stumbled metaphorically.
Oh, sister, can you hear?
And then I stumbled actually.
Oh, sister, can you hear?
That rainy night, that old moon.
Oh, night becomes a day.
I came all wet and late, but I'm never late to meet you.
So I'll go straight to Girard's mimetic double bind. This is René Girard. I suggest you look him up and familiarize yourself with his work, because it's very useful. It will be very useful if you're going to listen to this podcast anyway.
You receive the command, imitate me. And at the same time, there is another command, which is, do not imitate me. So these two commands come at the same time. And this double bind is, I think, what education should warn children about peers. Any master and disciple are in a double-bind situation with each other. The master wants his pupil to imitate him as diligently and effectively as possible. But if the pupil is too effective, he will suddenly overshadow, become better than the master. And the master will see the contradiction and will not dare say, you imitate me too well, or will not even think that. He will try to find something wrong with his disciple. So the double bind, there is a tendency never to express it, because if you express it, you express the essential contradiction of living together, which is competition.
Girard found in Freud's psychoanalytical theory a precursor to mimetic desire. The individual who adjusts has managed to relegate the two contradictory injunctions of the double bind, to imitate and not to imitate, to two different domains of application. This is, he divides reality in such a way as to neutralize the double bind. Well, I know about this double bind personally as far as imitation for a child. It's not safe to imitate, but it's not safe not to imitate. Because my brother was my closest peer, as in the person that I was most inclined to imitate and model my behavior after as a way to feel safe, or a way to feel like I knew how to function. And he was very threatened by my presence and very hostile towards it. And he reacted badly when I imitated him, but he reacted perhaps even worse when I was too much myself, when I did things that expressed my own authentic nature. Then that challenged his position of dominance within the family, and so it was a no-win situation. And I guess according to Girard, this is a general situation. This is not particular to my own upbringing. I just have my own particular example of it. I suggest that you cast your mind back to your own formative years and try and think of a similar situation in which you were damned if you did and damned if you didn't. Continuing on, far from being restricted to a limited number of pathological cases, as American theoreticians suggest, the double bind, a contradictory double imperative, or rather a whole network of contradictory imperatives, is an extremely common phenomenon. In fact, it is so common that it might be said to form the basis of all human relationships. A child possesses no perspective that will allow him to see things as they are. He has no basis for reasoned judgments, no means of foreseeing the metamorphosis of his model into a rival. As in, again, my own example, that my brother was my model for behavior, but he rapidly metamorphosized into a rival and a threat to me. This model's opposition, it reverberates in his mind like a terrible condemnation. He can only regard it as an act of excommunication. The one that we try to imitate rejects us and even threatens our livelihood, then we are completely adrift, all at sea, alienated.
So when the community says to a person, you must be free, or when we are in a family relationship in which the members of the family are saying to each other, you must love me, it's your duty to love me, what a bunch of rot. Supposing one day you get up and you say to your wife, darling, do you really love me? And she replies, well, I'm trying my very best to do so. Is that the answer you wanted? No. You wanted her to say, darling, I can't help loving you. I love you so much I could eat you. You don't want her to try to love you. But yet that is what you put on people in almost any marriage ceremony. That you shall love this person. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. This is a double bind. And anybody who lives under the dominance of a double bind lives in a state of chronic frustration, because he is devoting his whole life to solving a meaningless, nonsensical problem.
No matter who, where, or why, they have to die. The reason this place become unlucrative, the owner of the farm needs more income. And the best way to guarantee the success of the operation, to avoid being broke, is break the fucking world. Kill it, beat it, explore it, exterminate the filthy people that believe blindly and wrong they are under control.
Hold it right there. Humour is more subversive than revolution, than information, than knowledge, than anything. Humour rightly applied. I think somebody said that to me recently. Not in those words, of course, but yeah, it doesn't mean that humour is essentially subversive. There's plenty of humour that is not subversive. It can be used in ways that are the opposite of subversive. But I think it does mean that anything that's aiming to be subversive and that doesn't have a lightness and a humour to it is going to fail at a basic level. And so what? So now I'm going to talk humorlessly about how important humour is. Just like David Icke, except he doesn't talk about humour at all. As far as I know, Alex Jones certainly doesn't. Hey, these are the guys I consider my peers, apparently. Am I really in that same camp? God help me. No, I'm not. I'm a liminalist. A liminal criminal. Who's trying to, what's the word? Clear out a little corner of this crazed culture for himself to exist inside of. This is the definition of autoculture, which is that autos, the self, creates its own culture in order to flourish within that. It's not a choice, it's a result of having a self that is not compatible with the dominant culture, that simply can't find a way into it. It can't flourish within it, it can't be nourished by it, and so it has no choice but to create its own local culture, its autoculture. That's what I do, alright? Podcasts, videos, comic books, forums, websites, blogs, posts, books. Funny how I save books to last. And rather less humorous thingamajigs than I would like them to be. Oh God. No, I'm losing it. Who am I this time? Yeah. Definitely not Eos Cephas. A far, far cry from the wind god, alas. Anyway, I seem to be a lot more frenetic lately. I don't know what that is about. Maybe it's because I haven't had an orgasm in like 2 months or more. Hey, how's that for TMI? Okay, so I'm babbling like this because I realized that not only was the previous passage rather dense informationally, but also it was rather humorless, and I don't like that. I feel it needs to be addressed, and I don't know how to address it. except by talking a lot of crap. My God, yes, if you have to try to be funny, you might as well try to be spontaneous. I worked out a plan for spontaneity. You have to see it. It's really amazing. For some reason, I thought of Anonymous at that point. We do not forget. We do not forgive. We are Anonymous. Are we now? My name is Anonymous. What's yours? So anyway, yeah, I had these notes. I might as well go back to the notes, really. It's better than reading off a freaking forum site. That was just too much. Okay. So anyway, the point was the double bind. Okay. It's like cognitive dissonance, but it's a bit different. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. We all know the situation, we're all in it, right? The solution to double bind is double think. You have to believe two opposing realities and paper over the contradiction in there, and actually you're splitting yourself in two. Not in a good way. So let's look at examples then. The dominant narrative, what is it? Well, the dominant narrative says, you know what it is, that you are the contents of your wallet, you are the friends on your Facebook page, you are the money in your bank, you are the job that you do, you are somebody's brother or sister or daughter or son or mother or father or husband or wife and so on. You are the sum of the various categories that the world has put you into. And of course, extended outward is the narrative of the world itself, which is that Islam terrorists shoot a policeman in the head by firing a foot over his head and then wander around Paris for half an hour and stop and have a picnic before while making their getaway, and nobody says, hey, what's going on here? Well, actually, of course, lots of people do say that, but most people don't listen and they don't care, really, because they don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, because it's really, it just feels stupid if you have to be in that camp. Well, it's not about feeling stupid, it's not safe. It's not safe. Is it safe? No, it's definitely not safe. So, there was an example of the dominant narrative versus the alternative narrative. You've got what the daily news tells us happened, which I didn't see or hear anything about that, because I don't refer to mainstream news. And then you've got the alternative narrative, which isn't necessarily, to begin with at least, presenting an alternative reading. It can begin simply by questioning the dominant narrative and saying, what's going on here? But because the mind really needs a narrative, just like fleas need a dog or a cat to feed on, or, oh, I'm so crap at metaphors, like like clothes need a horse, I guess, or an emperor, because of that, pretty soon a narrative gets spun together. And actually the term false flag, let's say that's the alternative narrative, Islam attack versus false flag. Now another example would be Hollywood, because that's my own personal interest. Hollywood as dream factory, as an entertainment industry, just making movies that are sometimes art, for profit and for artistic satisfaction, versus the more David Icke-ian version, which is that it's a kind of industrialized blood bank run by reptilian pedophiles who are siphoning off the psychic energy of the masses in order to make themselves large with power. Well, which is true? I, of course, lean towards the Aikin version, but I can't really fully embrace that one because I know that it's just a bit lacking in nuance. It might not be as completely implausible and kind of insulting to our intelligence as the everything is what it seems, nothing to see here, movie stars are just nice people like you and I, only with more money and good looks. But it's still kind of iffy, it kind of stinky, because it just doesn't allow for the snafu of human behavior, the variation of degrees, like there's a whole spectrum there, like how a system like that operates. And so I personally experienced this enormous cognitive dissonance because I cannot believe the Hollywood narrative, you know, the mainstream narrative, that it's just a, you know, dream factory that everyone would like to belong to if they could. But I can't completely cancel that out with the more paranoid parapolitical version. Apart from anything else, I don't have enough information. Like, I can't confirm that narrative. And so it's an incomplete narrative. And I am an unreliable narrator. Like, I'm trying to make it make sense, but it doesn't. So, in either case, the Hollywood case or the Charlie Hebdo or name your latest terrorist staged event, school shooting, what have you, of course, the alternative to false flag is that it didn't happen at all, like the whole thing was staged, which isn't mutually exclusive with false flag, because it could still have the same desired effect. Point is, both of these points of view are unsustainable. Either because they're just plain false, or because they're oversimplified and we can't really get the evidence for them. We can't confirm them. And so what the mind does when it's faced with this double bind is it tries to find some middle ground. You've got two opposing points of view, and after bouncing back and forth between them for a while, or people do get stuck in one, obviously that's the thing, most people are stuck in one or the other, but they're becoming increasingly untenable. It's becoming harder and harder to just stay to subscribe to a narrative that is making less and less sense. You have to essentially, what do? You just start ignoring the evidence more and more, and you just repeat the narrative over and over to yourself, even though you've got nothing to support it. That's the way that you maintain it. So you actually become the narrator of the narrative, which is kind of what happens when somebody questions the narrative and there's a whole kind of rising up of reactions saying, you're a conspiracy theorist. Well, no, actually, I was just questioning the evidence here. It seemed it didn't quite add up there. Hadn't even begun to theorize and hadn't mentioned the word conspiracy, actually. But because the dominant narrative is having such a hard time dominating by the quality of the narrative itself, it's like a really bad Hollywood movie that nobody could believe. The need to suspend disbelief becomes greater and greater, and so in order to maintain the narrative, the people have to actually keep defending it more and more. I need to take a shit.
But try not to reach the total annihilation. Get some of them. Let them to prosper, reproduce, and fill the earth. Let them even think they are in charge again. Thank you. but they are just puppets, guided by the masters that are playing magnificently.
Yeah, just that really. I'm kind of going all over the map. Now, attempt to find middle ground is hopeless because, like capitalism and socialism, they are mutually exclusive, and middle ground equals the worst of both worlds. Yeah. What a fucking mess, really. So, I got an example here that we can all experience right now, if you're sitting comfortably, whether you're not, and that is the time, the experience of time. The past and the future are the alternative narratives. We can live in the past or we can live in the future. They are as if they're the solid ground, even though the past is gone and the future isn't here. They are solid to us because they have a narrative, whether it's a fictional narrative of the future, fantasy, or whether it's a factual narrative of the past, well, factual in quotes. We can take refuge in that narrative and feel like we are on the ground. We have some safe place to be, and something that we can identify with, and a context that we can experience ourselves in. The present, on the other hand, even though it's all we have, is actually nothing at all, because the present is gone. Look at it. Whoop, there it went again. It's infinitesimal. Like, you can't, there's no particle of time that you can reduce the present to and say that's it. It's infinitesimal. It is. The present is infinitesimal as time itself is infinite. So we're completely adrift in this present moment. We can't find it, but we can't get out of it either. That's liminality. Just being caught in the moment. And not being able to land. There is no place to land in the present because it's gone. The moment you recognize it, it's gone. So there's the next one coming in. Up, try to land on that one, it's gone. It's like sinking stepping stones. You can't. You just have to sink or fly. So that's the fundamental experience of human consciousness, is that adrift in time, caught between the double bind of two narratives. Neither of which is actually real, past and future. So, having said all that, there is no unit of time, I already said that. So, liminalism is not to move from an old state to a new state, because every future becomes the past. Yeah, we think that we're evolving and progressing from some past state to some future state, that we can arrive there, but of course you can't ever arrive in the future, because when you do, the future then becomes what you're moving away from, naturally. I'm stating the very obvious now. What the hell was the point to that? Do I even know? I mean, this podcast is moving from the beginning to the end. The beginning was in the past, the end is still in the future. Why? No good reason at all. Just to extend the present moment for long enough that I can eat some food at the end of it. I can smell the broccoli's cooking down below in the nether realms. What the hell am I doing this for? I mean, really, I'm just performing like a mile a minute, like I'm freaking Lenny Bruce or something. I have no audience. I mean, you, if you're listening to this, you're not my audience. Don't kid yourself. What was I? So, liminalism. Yes, the liminal state is to accept being in between the past and the future, between one's old state and one's imagined new state, forever. You can't arrive at the new state, because when you do, it will become the old state that you're trying to move out of. Duh. I didn't like the sound of that duh, to redo it. Duh. Okay, fuck it. Now I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed by myself. Process of change itself is the only thing that never changes. Now that's deep. Change itself is the only thing that doesn't change. Well, that's not that deep, because that's been said. Change is the only constant. I just rephrased it so it seemed like I'd come up with it all on my own. So if change is the only thing that doesn't change, the act of changing is the only thing that doesn't change, what? This is, the existence is non-existence. This is how existence is non-existence, because that which recognizes itself as existing is gone by the time it has recognized itself as existing. There you go, I got it. Space is the only constant. Now we're getting very cosmic. Space between things. Space is the context that contains all things. Space is the liminal state. It's what is eternal. Space, nothingness. It seems like nothingness, but it's full of something. I'm moving on at a breakneck speed. Now I'm going to get whiplash if I'm not careful. Dominant narrative versus conspiracy narrative. Both require agency. Yeah, right. So, this is the problem that we're presented with.
And this predicament in Zen is called a mosquito trying to bite an iron bull. A position of such psychic extremity that nothing can be done about it. Now the point here is, what does this situation mean? When you find yourself in that kind of a trap, what's the meaning of the trap? Why, that's very simple. If there's nothing you can do, and also nothing you cannot do about a given situation, it means that you are phony. That, in other words, what we call a separate ego isn't there. Of course it can't do anything, because it is not an agent. And by virtue of the fact that it can't do anything, equally, it can't not do anything. It's completely phony. So what has happened is, to expose the fiction of there being a separate ego, either to force its actions upon the world, or to have the actions of the world forced upon it as a puppet. This thing just doesn't exist, except as a figment of the imagination, or except as a game rule. Let's pretend everybody is responsible, is independent, is separate. Sure, that's a great game, but it's a game.
If the idea that we are individuals acting on the world is false, then in a sense the parapolitical narrative that describes the various conspiracies and agendas, groups, factions, hidden whatever's behind the scenes, that whole thing is as false. Like, every number is equally insignificant compared to infinity. That supposedly correct narrative, or the one that is a corrective to the false dominant narrative, is as false as the dominant narrative, because the it's predicated on a false idea, that of agency. But here's the final twist of the corkscrew in the apple. Here it is. What is it? The realization on the statement that I'm making about this, that the idea of agency is false, itself disproves itself. It cancels itself out, because if there is no agency to realize this, to choose to believe this, then nothing has happened. I don't know. I don't even know where to go with that one. I'm just getting warmed up. I just want to like myself doing this. And so you can all like me too, and I can like you for liking me. Liminalism says both are wrong because there is no agency, a position impossible to take, believe, because to believe it is to cancel out that which chooses what to believe. Like everything I say is a lie. Everything I say is a lie. Everything. Remember that. To decide that which is, that there is no agency, is to negate itself. Words themselves are liminal. The passage from inner felt experience to outer action, expression. That's what words are. Language is like money. It only exists because we have agreed to believe it does. Yes, we use language to convince ourselves that language exists, that it's real, that it's actually communicating something. We are embedded or imprinted or conditioned by language with the idea that language has meaning. Amazing, isn't it? How the fuck does that work? It's like a possession. It is like an alien virus that enters into us and takes us over and then says, I am. More or less. It's more or less like that. And I am now going to go and check on the broccoli, because I've got more important things to do than babble endlessly. Right, so free speech. This is what the whole Charlie Hebdo thing was about, as far as I could gather, and the big irony of it, and irony is perhaps rather an inadequate word for it, the tragic irony of it, that in the name of free speech, further infringements upon freedom of expression are being implemented. The Charlie Hebdo thing, it's not really about free speech, because they did something, if we believe the narrative, and it made some Islams angry, and the Islams reacted. Well, it's just kind of occupational hazard if you're going to satirize angry Muslim jihadists, right? Actually, free speech, the real encroachment of free speech around the Charlie Hebdo thing was the reaction to this event. This, I think, is not a random thing. I mean, this is the crux of it. We're talking about any kind of speech that is in service of values. It is not free. And so what do we get if we have the value of free speech? It's a value that, as a democratic person, you have to uphold it. It's like you have to speak freely. You have to stand up for freedom of speech. So that's like the double bind of that you must imitate, and you must be individual. You must imitate individuality in the West. You must be an individual. It says orange juice, spinach, and butter on my notes, because it used to be a shopping list, a very short one. Who gets to say what's real? What's reality? Who does? Is it you? Is it me? No, it is not. Is it God? Well, here's the thing, you see, God is a word. God is the product of language. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. Right? In the beginning of the ego was the word God. In the beginning of the word God, wait, in the beginning of God was the word I, not ego. God didn't say, I am the biggest ego around. But he could have done. Like, maybe in the original version. Or if the Bible had been written before Freud, I mean after Freud. Freedom of speech is important, not because there are important things that are important to say, and not because it's important to be able to say what's on our mind in itself, because language is not communicating anything anyway. I mean, the Tao that can be spoken is not the true Tao, and the conspiracy that can be explained is not the true conspiracy, right? Got it? But the voice is the bodily expression of our inner world. And for the soul to come all the way in to the body, to be fully embodied, it requires an expression. We only discover what's within us to express by expressing it. And if we are inhibited in our speech, externally or worse still, internally, that can never happen. Because we can't let go, we can't let rip and spontaneously erupt whatever it is that is within us to erupt. We will be censoring, we will be hesitant, we will be vacillating, we will be chastising, we will be judging, we will be fearing, we will be gauging the safety of this expression the whole time, and spontaneity simply can't happen. In order to belong to this group, you have to be an individual. That's it, really, isn't it? That's the double bind of social human existence. And the flip side of this imposition of freedom of speech is the hate crime. The flip side of thou shalt love thy fellow man as thyself, thy neighbor as thyself, is that it is a crime to hate. So what if I do hate, then? And I'm a criminal, and I must hate myself for hating. Which means...
So what if I do hate, then? And I'm a criminal, and I must hate myself for hating.
Which means that essentially the social command to love thy neighbor is... a subtle command to hate yourself. Because you can't love your neighbor if it's a command. You will hate your neighbor, and then you will hate yourself for not being a loving neighbor. And then you'll hate your neighbor even more, and so it goes, perpetuating eternally a vicious circle that spins faster and faster with every imposed value. And every law, and every junction. So it seems like to me, and underneath it all, the only problem anywhere, for anyone, is simply that, the inability to love. And the inability to love is not solved by the injunction to love, it is perpetuated by the command, thou shalt love.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when his world came tumbling down.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your prey. Monkey said
man, my desire is to be like demon kind. And this was all the monkeys built when his word came tumbling down. Here comes the monkey, and the monkey speaks his mind. Oh, here comes the monkey, and the monkey speaks his mind. Oh, here comes the monkey, and the monkey speaks his mind. Was all that monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down.
La fille dans la jungle, c'est quand même bien sympa. Mais les voleurs de bois nous posent des problèmes. Les songes sur les arbres préparent mon goût.
All the monkeys spoke when his world came tumbling down.